The following is a panel discussion held at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi, Texas, on July 11th, 2015. It was held as part of the Mexican American Studies Program Summer Seminar in conjunction with the South Texas Hispanic Farm Labor Community's Oral History Project. The participants are Irma Woods, Rosa Linda Reynoso, and Renato Ramirez. And the panel is moderated by Derek Oden. The recording started late due to technical difficulties.
Because of the machine, the noise, it was too noisy. And so we couldn't talk to each other, even though we were like that, because we couldn't hear. So one time on the assembly line, when it started, it was like a U. There was this, of course, the machine picked up everything, dirt, the whole plant. And then there was a snake. And it came around the assembly line. So it was like, I would tell, bump her and then bump the other. So we were just like, okay, the snake came right free. So, I have so many, but I'm going to go ahead and let Dr. Woods go next.
Hi, I'm a second generation Mexican American. My parents were born here in the United States, but my grandparents are from Mexico. They came to the United States because of the Mexican Revolution in 1910. They came to this country, and they settled in the Yorktown-Cuero area. And they were, both families on my father's side and my mother's side were farm workers. They worked the land. They toiled for years. They came to the United States, of course, to seek a better life. And my mother did not like farm work. She did not like working in the fields. So she convinced me. She married at the age, I need to tell you, my grandmother had 19 children. And my mother was the third oldest. So it's interesting that my mother was pregnant with her first child, and my grandmother was pregnant with her last child. So you can see how I'm the third of my mother's children. And so my aunts and uncles, many of them were close. I was close to their age. They were older, of course, but not much more than I was. My mother convinced my father to move. They worked the lands around Yorktown and Cuero, picking cotton and various products. My mother convinced my father to leave farming, to go come to the city, because she did not want to pick work in the fields anymore. She had children and she wanted city life. So they moved to Corpus Christi. My father became a dishwasher at a restaurant here in Corpus Christi. He got a little house on Mestenia Street that does no longer exist. It is covered by the courthouse today. So where I was born at home, delivered by a midwife, and that street is no longer there. But my grandmother, on my mother's side, was my greatest influence. I followed her, and she still worked the fields. When I was 5 years old, I would go with my grandmother and my aunts and uncles, and we would go out and work the cotton fields and pick tomatoes in Florida, cucumbers in Michigan, and we would just follow the crops. I was not in school yet, so I could go along. But because I was only 5 years old, I was just a water girl. I would take water to people out in the fields. But I was also the lookout girl. What that meant is there were no bathroom facilities for anybody working on the fields. So when you think about it, how do you manage? I was the lookout girl. There was an old oilcloth that I would use to hold it up and hold it while my aunts went to the bathroom. So they would have some degree of privacy. I didn't have to do it for the men, just for the women. And I was real glad about that. But it was an experience that shaped me for the rest of my life. Because later in my career, I think that's what propelled me to go into the field of child development. Because I saw the conditions in which children and families lived. And I was too young to understand it then. I didn't understand it until much, much later. But I became an advocate for families and children. And I think to a large extent, that's why I went into the field of early childhood. My biggest memory is picking tomatoes with my aunts and uncles and feeling the fuzz of the stem. It was fuzzy, and when you pick the tomato, it hurts. It hurts your hands. And that's a very vivid image I have. I never forgot it. And today when I go to the grocery store and they have the tomatoes on the vine, you see the four tomatoes on the vine, I always look to see if there's fuzz on it. Because I remember how much it hurt my hands. Of course, I was just so young. But by the time I was in the fifth grade, my grandmother said I should no longer work in the fields. And my grandmother was the first person who told me I was smart. No teacher had ever told me that before. And I realized that my grandmother saw the potential in me. She saw that I was intelligent, that I could go far. And she said, you stop working in the fields and you stay in school. And that's what I did.
Wow.
You can stay.
Oh, no, that's fine. I don't need the mic. It's okay. You can hear me. I'm not necessarily very politically correct. I was born in the rough barrios of San Diego and Alice and down here in South Texas. My name is Renato Ramirez. I wanted to mention, Derek Oden didn't introduce himself. He's Derek Oden, a historian and professor from Del Mar College and a very good friend of mine. And when he brought up the idea that when he opens his refrigerator in the morning and sees the fruits and vegetables, I hope he can remember me because I've often been called fruit by detractors, and as I get older, I'm slowly becoming more and more of a vegetable. You know, so
don't say that.
Well, that's okay. But you can remember me whenever you open the fridge. You know, think about me. My family comes from Los Reyes Ranch in between San Diego and Freer off of Highway 44. It was founded by three brothers, Salomon Reyes, Martin Reyes, and I don't remember my other uncle's first name, but they settled that area in the 1880s after Porfirio Diaz took over in Mexico. As Jim Klein was talking about yesterday, the push and pull of immigration into this area, my family is actually, I'm a direct descendant of Juan José Bahí, who had land grants. He and his uncle, Nicolás, Padre Nicolás Bahí, had land grants that helped establish the cities of Matamoros, Reynosa, Miel, Camargo, and then Padre Island, okay? And they date back, these grants date back to the 1700s and perhaps even earlier. So we were pushed in the period of expansion out of central Mexico into this area as exploration came about into this region. And as poverty struck and immigration from up north came in this direction as well, we were eventually pushed back into Mexico and then came back in the 1880s and settled in the brush country between San Diego and Freer. Okay? And in that area of Los Reyes, they built a church. They built a one-room schoolhouse as well. And all my parents, my mother and father and all my brothers and sisters were born at home, most of us on the ranch, some of us in town. We eventually moved to San Diego, but we had a midwife birth us all at home as well. And some of my earliest memories of working were picking cotton with my mother and my brothers and sisters. We never traveled out of state. We just emptied the neighborhood in San Diego where we grew up on a flatbed truck every morning at about 4 in the morning, drive out to the field, get there at sunup, and the entire neighborhood would go. Almost the entire city, basically, you know. And we'd pick, I was probably about 6 years old at the time. I was old enough at that time to actually get a cotton bag for minors, okay, for young folks. It was a smaller bag than the adults carried, and it was very easy to fill up. And I would, after I'd fill it up, I'd pour it into my mother's or my brother's bag, a bigger bag, so that I could contribute to that, you know. And I remember Rosalinda telling me that, one of my memories was that when it got too hot during the day, they would put some of the young kids that were less than 10 years old under the truck. That was the only shade around, okay? And so we'd sit there. And I remember Rosalinda telling me last week that one time she witnessed a child get run over when the truck took off after it was filled and get killed. And that was one of the dangers that you would always had about that, you know. And also snakes were very
snakes.
Common. That's in the fields. I remember when we'd kill a snake, it was a means that we'd hang it on a fence, and hopefully that would bring about some rain, okay? That was a common, not necessarily a myth, but a belief that they had, that ranchers and farmers in this area, if you kill a snake, and especially a poisonous snake, you put it on a fence, and that's going to bring some rain, okay? And that was one of the early beliefs that we generally had. But my father ended up fighting in World War II. When he came back, he was able to get a job at the base here. But we still, he was doing custodial work, okay? And we still needed money. And so everybody else in the family ended up picking cotton. And my next door neighbor was my grandfather and grandmother. They picked cotton in their old age. And their next door neighbor was their other son and daughter-in-law and their family, and they picked cotton. So it was just the entire neighborhood going, picking cotton every day when it was, when the weather allowed it, you know, at a very early age. And we picked in front of a, there was an egg, there was a gin, cotton gin in front of the fields that we used to pick that were between San Diego and Alice, and it was called the Eggemeyer Gin. I don't know if anyone has ever driven Highway 44 in that direction. It used to be right, very prominently right by the highway, and across the highway was a vast expanse of cotton fields, and that's where we would pick every morning, well, every day, and then take the crop right across the street to the cotton gin and have the bales made. And so it was a very efficient type of labor at that time. But still, it was very labor-intensive and very poorly paid. But that was an experience that I had as well.
I think it was 10 cents a pound, the cotton. Is that correct?
Well, it was very low.
It was very low.
Right.
I wanted to say that my grandmother made a little cotton sack for me because I was so young. I was 6 years old. And she made a little... Renata was addressed with the size. It was very small. I think you could only... Maybe
right.
Like
10 pounds.
Right, right. But I thought it was a lot. It was heavy.
Sure. And
the adults would pick 100-pound bags, 100 pounds.
Those would drag
and
for
those would drag,
yards back.
Yes.
Right.
And then I remember weighing the bags at 10 cents a pound. For one 100-pound sack, they got $1. It was hard, hard work. It was harsh. But as a child, I just thought that's the way it was. I didn't question it. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. That's just the way it was. And you dealt with it as you came to it. But I was fortunate. I got to keep the cotton that I picked. I didn't have to turn it in. Because then my grandmother would make little mattresses and pillows for me to play with. So I would play. I got under the truck and I didn't have to go do bathroom duty or take
very
water.
Similar experience.
I would stay under the truck and play with little rocks and sticks and the little mattresses that my grandmother would make for me from the cotton that I picked. So it was an incentive for me to pick the leftover cotton, the leftovers. And it was very hard to pick the cotton. You got pricked. You have to be just so perfect to pick out that cotton without getting pricked from the, what do you call it? I forgot how you call it in Spanish. The
The what?
The container that holds the cotton.
It's a Spanish word.
Yeah, something like that.
El capullo.
El
capullo.
Capullo. That means the little cup where the cotton is. And it was hard.
Limited.
But anyway, it was...
I said that I was in the fifth grade, so it was 69. I forgot to mention that was the first year we went up north, and I was fifth grade going into sixth grade. And there was summer of 69. You all know where you were, summer of 69, July.
Sure.
We were just getting in Ohio, and I remember the grown-ups, the truck driver, my dad, and his brother. We got to the truck driver's brother. He was already in Ohio. Hurry up, hurry up. Come on, you're going to miss it. And we didn't know what was going on. Oh, it was only the astronaut first landing on the moon, whatever. One of those things. So, I mean, we were kids, and but having said that, that's how we started fifth grade. The June, we went with the neighborhoods, like the Natusit, and they took us, and we did the cotton, and we did the bombón, which is the okra.
The okra.
And the cotton, since I was older than 5 years old or six, so we it was just me and my brother, my younger brother, and we did the larger bag. And we're so happy because we worked all day, and we did take a break under the truck, but it was we were several, so the man didn't take off with all of us under it. But we made $10, and we were so happy. I gave him $5, and I got $5. But it was hard work, and, being at that age, you just think that's the way it is. You don't think. And then when we went up north, and we saw that, the first man on the moon, we didn't know, but that's where my memory is on that, 1969 July, and I'm like, okay. But now you look back, and you realize, those memories, you don't forget that. It's just there. And I have so many because I was in my teens, 10 through 19, so I have more vivid memories and of the picking and the other stuff that goes with it. But I know that there's two other questions, so I'm going to...
Sure, I can ask another question.
Two other questions.
Yeah, I'm just having a great time listening to everybody. Can't wait to listen to the recording and go through this again. But my question was, we were talking about conditions. We mentioned the truck and, child labor. And one of the things I was thinking about as everybody was saying that is that agriculture is one of the least regulated industries. Mm-hmm. And another thing that came to mind when we were talking was that even into the late 20th century, the average life expectancy for farm workers is 49. And sitting here at 42, that seems very, very, very young, So my question is just kind of to continue on with this question of challenges. But, a lot of times when we think about agriculture, we think of kind of an organic process. But when you think about the 20th century, we think about tractors and trucks and pesticides and herbicides and all the chemicals that really come into farming in the late 20th century. So I just wanted to kind of couch the question, what were some of the health, health challenges that you might have experienced? And Renato was talking about older folks working in these fields as well, and even little kids, very little children as well. So are there any memories that you have of health conditions? And I remember reading in Irma's biography there about the number of children and childbirth in these situations. And so I just thought I would, if you could think about health and dangers, and specifically, crop dusters, that sort of thing. I'm going to go ahead and let you start. I've already talked too long. So,
okay. For health, we were lucky. None of us got, sick during the time. Of course, there might be some effects later. I know I've already lost my brother from diabetes. My sister has diabetes and, stuff like that. But I'm not saying it's from that. But you don't know if the effects until later, years later. I'm still young, by the way. The other thing is the childbirth. My youngest brother was born in Ohio, And but the hospital, when my mother, we got in Ohio, Findlay, Ohio, and the ranch house we got, well, with that we arrived at, it was like 30 minutes away. And so she had traveled from North Dakota to Ohio, because that's where we were in North Dakota, and we would move from North Dakota to Ohio to Indiana, you know, and vice versa. But we had gotten there, and she got sick. She started feeling sick. Of course, she was already, you know, almost 9 months pregnant, and so they took her, and it took a while, and, you know, they did. It was a C-section, but that's, I don't know if it's due to the traveling and also the time. I mean, it could have been worse, you know. There are some dangers, especially childbirth out there. But the other dangers, I think, is if it happened. I know that when we were in North Dakota with the sugar beets, you have to work with the hose and you have to sharpen those hoses. And sometimes, you know, you have accidents. Yeah, I know one, it happened to one of my brothers when he was sharpening. But it wasn't a bad cut to where, you know, we took care of it right there and then. But we had first aid stuff right there.
Thank you.
Stories that my grandmother told me, I mean, her 19 pregnancies, by the way, 6 of the children died in infancy, and 13 remained. And they, of the 13 who grew up to adulthood and have families, 6 have died, and there are 7 left. My mother is the oldest of the 7. She turned 90 years old this past April. She is currently in a nursing home with the last stage of Alzheimer's. But I remember my grandmother telling stories about her pregnancies. She was working in the fields until the water broke. She was just working and working. The water broke, and she would rush to the house to give birth. My mother would run to the neighboring farm, which was pretty far away. She would run and call somebody to come help my mother, help my grandmother. And my grandmother sometimes delivered children by herself because there was nobody around. So the lack of health, and no health insurance. So they never went to the doctor unless they were really, really, really sick, because they didn't have money to pay for a doctor. So that was one of the greatest challenges of being a farm worker. And being away from a city with facilities, medical facilities, so they, you know, they develop cures to help each other, and neighbors help one another, especially when women were giving birth. But those were really, really difficult times, and my grandmother took it all in stride. That's just the way it was. And I remember growing up with that idea. And so I didn't become an advocate for children and families until I was grown up, until I went to college. And I learned that there was a man named Cesar Chavez who was organizing unions for farm workers. And so I joined the cause. I became an activist at that time. And I joined the cause, and I joined the boycott for grapes. I didn't eat grapes for I don't know how many years.
I still
have a hard time eating grapes, because I don't know the misery that the farm worker went through to get those grapes on the table. Oh, I forgot.
Related to what Irma was saying, I went to Pan American University shortly after I graduated in 1972, just briefly, but at that time, is when the United Farm Workers Union was organized in the Valley by Tony Orendain. And he was able to get Cesar Chavez to come down to the Valley and bring his stature to bear on the farm owners down there, people like Lloyd Benson and the McAllen family and others. One of the problems with the pesticides was that there was a lot of runoff of the chemicals into the water system. Mm-hmm. And these babies were being born. I mean, people would consume the water, and then babies were being born with defects. A common defect that was found in the Valley, that was found nowhere else in the country, was anencephaly, which was a babies being born without their brainstem. And this was directly linked to the chemicals in the water that were directly associated with the pesticides being used in the fields, you know. And I think that helped bring Cesar Chavez down to the valley. The fact that you had old world diseases and mutated babies being born that weren't happening anywhere else in the country. So that was one of the major health effects as well.
I just briefly wanted to mention, we look at the physical effects of dangerous materials in the environment. But the other problem that occurred with farm workers who were separated from their families was the depression. And we didn't talk too much about depression at that time as a mental condition. But families who were separated from one another because of the work situation often went into depression. Sadness that they were away from their families. They didn't know if they would see them again because of the dangers of being a farm worker. And I remember mothers crying for their husband, you know, children crying for their mothers. It was years later, when I had a better understanding of children's development, I realized the effect that it had on the families, particularly on the children.
I can relate to that because I mentioned the two younger brother, my sister, my brother. They would go to the farm and pick them up, migrant school. It was called Texas Migrant School. They had Texas Migrant School all over, you know, the North Ohio, Michigan. I think everywhere we went, they had a Texas migrant school, and they would go to all the farms, different farms, and very early, mind you, and pick them up and. One year I got, my last year, I had already graduated, so they asked me to go help them in the bus. So I would go in the buses with them and pick up the children. And you're right, the first day it was crying, and there I am trying to, and then of course it's Spanish. You have to talk to them in Spanish. They don't know any English. You're talking about 3, 4, 5 year olds, and we had infants, but those infants and some other ladies would take care of them. So I would take care of the 3, 4, and 5 year olds mainly, but in the bus it was all ages. And but I would talk to them in Spanish and tell them just to keep their mind off their separation from the family for the whole day. And I would tell them, oh, qué bonito vestido, what a pretty dress you have. And this girl is crying, oh, quién te lo compró tu mami, your mommy bought you this dress, oh, you have a good mommy. You know, trying to take their mind off that they were going to be separated. And then I would tell them, a ratito vamos a volver a ver a tu mamá, and we're just going to go have some fun, go learn stuff. And I would tell them all that in Spanish. And just trying to, you know, to let them know it's okay, you know, it's going to be all right. And then at the end, we would have to, in the afternoon, we'd have to take a nap, after lunch nap, and then we'd round them off and drop them off. And then I would tell them, okay, you have to take a nap. After the nap, then we're just going to get a snack, and then we go home. You're going to go home. And they were like, okay. And they would take a nap. They would take a nap. Because some of them didn't want to take a nap. They were, like, very hyper. And but they, you know, that's one of the other experiences that I have, because I did it so many summers. So, but yeah, the children, I can relate to that. So.
But the last question we'll have, and we'll save a little bit of time for some questions from the audience, but we mentioned a little bit about union organizing and efforts to improve these conditions. And I thought we'd just take a little bit of time and just comment on that before we have our audience ask some questions. So any recollections of farm workers' movements in California or even the Midwest, in places like Ohio and Michigan and those places, there was a very active campaign organizing there. And so that's something that I really want to talk about as well, because sometimes we forget about the Midwest. But
okay, well, like I said, I was 13 years, so in the 70s, I was a teenager, pre-teen or teen, whatever you want to call it. But I do remember the Cesar Chavez movement. We would be in the fields, and they would, and this is Ohio, Indiana, the three or four years that between the 70s. One other thing that I do remember is the Nixon trials, the Nixon,
the Watergate.
Yeah, Watergate. Okay, so that was, anyway, see those things that you remember, it's like, you know, I remember that. It was like, but I was a teenager, so it was like, you know, again, another day with this thing going on. I didn't realize, you know, how really important it was. But the Cesar Chavez woman, the early 70s, one of the years, I think it was 72, that I mentioned that we went to California. You could hear that a lot in California. It was Cesar Chavez here, Cesar Chavez there. And, of course, I wasn't, my mind wasn't set like as an adult to realize what it all involved as far as activism. I just knew about it, but I didn't really participate. I couldn't make the connection because I was kind of in between. So
I was fortunate enough to attend Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio for my college. I began my college studies there. And at that time, the Catholic Church was just emerging with the concept of social justice. And this was in the 60s. So we were introduced to the concept of social justice, and the plight of the farm worker became prevalent. So the movement of Cesar Chavez became very strong in San Antonio. So I joined the movement in San Antonio, where we boycotted grocery stores and boycotted any business that sold fruits and vegetables. As college students, we were on fire. Have you ever been on fire on anything? It's something that propels you to do things that you normally wouldn't do. And I'm a quiet, shy person. But when it came to families and children, and what I knew from experience was happening out in the field, I was on fire. And my children today cannot believe that. But Mom, you mean you were like that? Yes, I was. My picture came out in the newspaper, you know, protesting, holding signs. And the Cesar Chavez movement became very, very critical and important to me. Thank you.
In 1968, in Mission, Texas, at La Lomita Monastery, MAYO, the Mexican American Youth Organization, held its first national conference there. And Carlos Guerra, who Manuel Flores talked about yesterday, was elected a national chairperson of the Mexican American Youth Organization. Carlos Guerra is from Robstown. And they decided right then and there that they're going to build a college for Chicanos. And they built Colegio Jacinto Treviño down in Mercedes, Texas. My brother was one of the original graduate students and a faculty member there as well. And that lasted for roughly about a decade. And one of the things they did was develop a curriculum that emphasized Chicano culture, Mexican-American culture. And another thing they did was to follow migrant students throughout the country and help them graduate from high school, because they never could do that on a timely basis. And so they helped them get their GED diplomas and helped them enroll in college as freshmen and helped teach them in a way that they would not be ashamed of their background and that they would be develop pride and honor their heritage, you know. And that was very, very unique. But it was also attacked very heavily as being a front for communist ideology and so forth. That was a way of organizing and protecting the livelihoods and the culture of these folks back then. That colegio didn't last more than a decade, but it eventually moved to St. Edward's University in Austin and became Juarez Lincoln University. And that lasted roughly for another decade as well. And my brother, Adolfo Ramirez, who wasn't here today, he was supposed to be here, helped organize and maintain that college. And I'm real proud of that, you know. But there were a lot of folks involved in that endeavor, and yet it's rarely ever mentioned publicly. You know. Thank you.
Excellent. Did he speak to us last year?
Say what?
Did he speak to us last year?
Yes, he did. Right.
Before I give it back to him, I just wanted to relay what he said about trying to finish high school, you know, the migrants. The way we did it, we would leave, we would be out by late April, early May, so we could go up north, travel up north. Big trucks at first and then on our own, and it was 50 miles an hour and big flatbeds. It took us 3 days, 2.5 days to get up there. And way back, we would late September, early October, and the challenges I would face is that even from our in the school, and I'm from Brownsville, so a lot of other Mexican Americans, they would say, "Oh, te bajaron, ustedes son a los norte, y'all go, you're so behind," you know. They would tell us stuff like that. So that kind of challenged me, and I said, no, you know, I'm not going to stay behind. And I never did, because we would have to go to tutoring after school, and we have to make up all those weeks, and then some. but I was determined. I said, no, I'm not going to, you know, whatever they would tell, you know, you would jeer and tell you stuff. And so we made it. That's how we finished school. I finished high school. I never got my school in the yearbook because I was always late, but I graduated. I know I did. I've got my diploma.
I just want to say one.
Oh yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want to say one more thing. I just want to say that my first teaching job was teaching first grade at a migrant school in San Juan, Texas. I understood where how the families worked. The children arrived in late October, early November, and left in April, late April. I understood because of my own experiences with farm workers, and I hope I was sensitive enough to guide them in their education.
Well, as you can see, we'd probably go a couple hours instead of 4. I'm so interested, I could sit here for easily 3 or 4 hours and listen to so many stories. But we have a couple minutes, hopefully, for 3 or 4 questions. And if you could just raise your hand or stand up and address our panelists and ask a question, and we'll go ahead and start with that.
I'll ask a question.
Yeah.
Did anyone else here work in the fields? There you go. Quite a few.
I think she got paid $3 for every 100 pounds.
Yes.
Back in the 40s.
I can relate to a lot of what you said, but I'd like to add one more challenge about the health issues. And I think drinking the water on the same cup, like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Dysentery, stuff like that.
Exactly.
And that was common practice. One
that was,
cup.
Mm-hmm.
That was
one ice chest, too.
Wow. The same, what do you call it, the cup?
Can I?
The barrel, whatever.
These have it tied to a string on the door of the truck, you know.
So you won't lose it.
or
it dropped or something. Yeah. That was a clean part, so it wouldn't drop on the floor and then reuse it. But everybody used the same one. I wanted to add something real quickly. When we went, the first time we went to pick strawberries, oh, yeah, at that age, we love strawberries. So we saw the field, and we're like, we're going to pick strawberries. And we're like, oh, strawberries. You don't think that they've been sprayed. So we would eat strawberry, just like, okay, one for us and one for us. Yes, it was like, I don't want to eat strawberries anymore. And the bologna sandwiches on the way up there. I was like, oh, bologna sandwiches, no more bologna sandwiches. And there's stuff that memories, you know, and I mean, I could go on and on, but.
Wow. Yeah.
The tortilla tacos.
Yeah.
Packed in a paper bag, no refrigeration, no coolers, no. It was at room temperature. The soda colorada, the red sodas.
The red sodas.
Very common.
Thank you, folks.
Yeah,
that's one question.
Huh? You mentioned
and I'm talking about the first lady, you mentioned you had to speak to children in Spanish.
Yes.
Now, were these children, where were they from? Were they from Mexico or were they born here in Texas?
No, from the valley. I mean, when we were in the Texas Migrant School, you had families from all over. Even Cuero, you know, Mission, Edinburgh, Brownsville, McAllen, Hidalgo. You had them. You had Ed Couch, Far Some One, Alamo. You know, you had families from the valley going up north, and the valley it was Spanish.
Spanish speaking.
That was the first language. I mean, I was Spanish for. I had an accent. Believe me, I don't have it anymore. But I had a very thick accent.
But there was only. Were this only the folks that were going, the migrant workers, or were there all the people that lived in the valley that did not speak English or practice English?
The adults, you mean?
No, everyone.
There were some parents that didn't know English at that time.
They came from Mexico. That's why they didn't know.
I don't know, sir. I was just when we went to the camps. The migrant, the camps, workers' camps, they were just there. And we'd just pick up the kids. The parents, you know, the ladies would take their kids on the bus stop, and we'd just pick them up. I wouldn't really talk to the parents.
I just want to add that the state of Texas funded a program called the Texas Migrant Council. Mm-hmm. And they set up child development centers throughout the state, particularly located where migrant families lived. And so what the Texas Migrant Council did is when families went north, the teachers from who lived in, let's say, Mercedes, mm-hmm. they would pack up also. The teachers would follow the families. So wherever they were, they would establish a school for the children. And, of course, I didn't learn English until I went to school. It was Spanish-speaking only mm-hmm. in my home. And so that was the case for most of these families as well. So the teachers followed the children. Wherever the families went, the teachers went with them. And they set up the Texas Migrant School. So you could have it in North Dakota, California, New Mexico, wherever. And these were the families from Texas. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, I also traveled with migrant workers. Not my family. I ran away from home when I was 12 years old, and I followed the families. And they spoke Spanish, but there was some English that also was being spoken. But I noticed when we went up north, and that's why I mentioned, was it only migrant families or was it all the families?
It's only migrant.
Because in a lot of cases, and by the way, I was born and raised in Laredo, Texas, and I traveled. I went again and joined migrant families, but they spoke Spanish and would not speak English. That's because they just didn't want to do that. But they could, but they elected not to. So when we went up north, I befriended with people that spoke English, you know, mm-hmm. while the other was coming, don't go over there, don't go with the gringos, stay with us. And I didn't, I went with the younger people and made friends. But yeah, that was an experience. The strawberries, mm-hmm. cherries, it was strawberries hanging down.
The cherries?
We were eating. The cherries.
Cherries. Yeah, cherries were the cherry trees.
I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, that too. You had a question?
Yeah, actually it's more of a comment. Bringing up the fact that your mother had given birth after moving from one state to another, that brings up the fact that there's no consistent prenatal care for mm-hmm. the women, and also just the labor delivery and I don't know if there have been programs that have developed since then that would be comparable, because we still have people moving from place to place with the mm-hmm. Migrant labor and so forth. And I don't know if...
I haven't kept up. After my last year, that was it. No, but no prenatal care.
Actually, now there are more clinics in rural areas, mm-hmm. so they have this. Medical care is more accessible today, and there's a greater awareness of the prenatal care necessary for safe delivery. So more of the rural areas have clinics for moms to go to, which did not exist at the time my grandmother gave birth.
Okay, I think we're going to stop now. I know there's a lot we could go on and on. I know I could go on and on because, I mean, my dad was a mechanic. When we stayed in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I could tell you stories about Kalamazoo, Michigan, being the only two families, Hispanic, in the high school. I was in high school then. it's just too many to share. Maybe during Hispanic Heritage Month, we'll do a session here at Del Mar for that. Okay.
We definitely have to do this again. I think we should give a round of applause to our panelists. Thank you so much for sharing your stories.